Right, so hello everybody. Welcome to Barnsdale Garden Question Forum. Just introduce myself to those of you who don't know who I am. I'm Nick Hamilton, so I own and run Barnsdale. I'm Jeff's middle son, and I've been here for, I think I'm in my 38th year now. So, man and boy. I know I don't look that old, I know. Don't laugh. They don't want to hear you laughing on the radio. They're supposed to believe me. And I'm ably assisted by John, the head gardener, who will now introduce himself.
Hi, I'm John, the head gardener, John Brocklebank, and I've been here almost as long as Nick, but not quite. 32nd year this year. So I came here as a trainee on what was the YTS scheme back in 1995, and I've been here ever since. So I know the gardens inside out, and hopefully can answer any of your questions.
Right, I can see you've all got burning questions, so we'll start with one. Somebody want to go first?
We lost a huge oak tree in the garden. We got rid of it, all the roots and everything, so we've made a new garden where it was. And I bought 4 aces. Years ago, about 10 years ago, I bought 2, and they're growing beautifully, magnificent. These 4, I didn't put them in the ground because of where it had been. The ground hadn't been worked or anything. I put them in pots, and after I bought them, I had them standing in water in containers for possibly a week, and the bronzy, was it, one was coming beautiful, 1 bronze, 3 green, slightly variegated. Once I planted them, they died, and I don't know why. I lost all of them the same. The leaves shriveled. I watered. I thought, am I giving them too much water?
Okay, so when you put them in the ground, what's your soil type?
No,
like?
No, I didn't put them in the ground.
Oh, you put them in the pots.
I put them in big pots.
Okay, so in the pots then, what was the compost that you planted them in?
Nothing spectacular.
Nothing spectacular.
Just ordinary compost. Multi-compost.
Multi-purpose compost.
Multi-purpose.
Okay.
I only put manure in with roses. I don't know if I should have put something else in.
No, okay. Did you want to answer this, John?
I must have been dreaming, and I didn't hear which plants you had in the pots.
Aces.
Oh, we had an acer question earlier.
About so high, would you say?
Yeah.
Well, they do prefer more of an ericaceous kind of compost, which might help there. But so you say you put them in the ground after you put them in pots?
I've got 2 in the ground I bought 10 years ago. So, you know, I obviously did similar things with them. And we've got 1, the lighter green, grows beautifully, taller than the bronze one, but they're both lovely. And when I saw these, I thought, I'll get some of these for the new garden. But just wanted to put them in pots. Mm. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, they're not next to each other or anything. Each one of them just died the same way with the leaves. And I couldn't blame the plant because they were lovely until I planted them.
So when you planted them, were they in quite a small pot prior to putting them in your pot?
I would say so, wouldn't you? Yeah. Oh, yes, a lot smaller than the pot I was using.
I'm just wondering what sort of root system they had on them.
Yes.
Obviously, in pots as well, they need good drainage holes because they don't like being too wet too dry.
They're well drained, weren't they?
Yeah. It's unusual for them to just die, and I can't really think of a reason what would cause that. Any ideas, Nick?
Yeah, I think the thing that came out at me when you first explained what had happened was the term multi-purpose compost.
Yeah, you think that's it?
Well, I think it's one of a few reasons, potentially. So multi-purpose compost is created to be able to sow into and also to pot into. But if you compare it to a potting compost has much larger elements in that compost to improve the drainage. Obviously, you don't want great chunks of bark if you're trying to sow into a compost. Also, with a multipurpose compost, the fertility level is very, very low, because if it was too high, then when seeds germinated, it would burn them off completely straight away. So a multipurpose compost is great for short-term potting, not for long-term potting. Right. That's the first thing. What I would therefore move on to that is the question that we always come to very first at the beginning is, how often did you water?
Quite frequently. Was it too much?
The problem, like I said, with the multi-purpose compost is the fact that it's created, we're using the smaller elements of what they put into compost, so you haven't got the bigger bits in there. Now, the bigger bits in there are in there to improve the drainage. And acers aren't easy to grow. As John said, they like an ericaceous compost, so they're neutral, so acid lover. So that doesn't help. So that means that you should also be watering them using rainwater. If your water at home is hard, right? If you've got soft water at home, it's okay. If your water at home is hard, if your kettle furs up, that's a no-no to be watering them with that. Mm. You really need to water with rainwater, which is problematic because we haven't had rainwater for about 15 years. No. It feels like that anyway. And so that's a problem. Yeah. I do honestly think you've overwatered.
Possibly.
Have you taken them out of the pot?
No.
No, okay. Well, always when something dies and you replace it, either like for like or with something different, then you should always try and determine as to the reason as to why it's died. Because the point is, if you don't, then you could put something else in exactly the same spot that's going to go down the same route. Now, I think you'll find that when you take your aces out of the pots, that they won't have rooted out into the compost. The roots will probably be rotten. So when you go to tease them away from the root ball, that they'll just come away in your hands.
Right.
And that's a sure sign. When you planted them, did they have foliage on them?
Oh, yes, they were beautiful.
And then what happened?
I've done something wrong.
What happened to the foliage?
Shriveled, started shriveling and going brown.
Yeah, okay.
I think you're right.
It's a root problem, and the root problem
is... I've used.
Well, I mean, root problems are either, as John said, we had a question like this earlier, and the thing that we were saying there was obviously is that, you know, problems with the top tend to come from the root, with the wilting and the shriveling. Mm. So if the roots aren't working properly, they're not drawing up the moisture that the top of the plant needs. Now, obviously, if the compost is too dry and there isn't water in there, they can't draw water up, so they wilt. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is if the roots have rotted, they also can't draw up water. So it does almost a similar thing. Yeah. As I said earlier, we're born with an index finger on both hands. You could test two pots at the same time, is what you use. If the compost is moist, don't water.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And overwatering, it's the killing with kindness thing. Overwatering, it's not easy to water, and overwatering is quite common.
Yeah.
But we do need to get these things right, because apart from the expense of it all, you know, you look forward to what they're going to become, and of course, therefore, it's not great when things don't work in that respect. So maybe look at what you're doing. Work on the principle that I always work on, is that if you're not sure whether to water, then don't. Because if it wilts from slightly being slightly underwater,
then
you water it 2 hours later, you'd never know it was wilting. Whereas if it wilts from over water, then the roots are dead and you may as well chuck it away.
Yeah.
So I think that's the answer. So what you need is a ericaceous potting compost. And if you can get one with a proportion of soil in it as well, that might help in that it means that you won't have to water quite so often, slightly meatier, hold on to the moisture more. And then rain back a little bit on the water. Don't wait for it to rain, because then they'll fry from being underwatered.
Well, we must have the right soil in the garden.
Yeah.
Because with this garden, then an arbour, and then the aces
right.
in soil.
Yeah.
And they never look back.
Well, you say that. We've got 4 Cercidophyllum in the garden, I think, which is what they commonly call the Katsura tree. It's my dad's favourite tree. And we planted one in the Country Paradise garden. And John dug the hole with a crowbar because it's solid limestone down there. Now, if you pick up any book, it will tell you that Cercidophyllum japonicum requires a neutral to acid soil, and we're planting it straight into lime, basically. And down there, okay, when you look at it compared to the other three, we've got one in the corner of the Modern Estate Garden, actually, which is doing really quite well, isn't it? But the one down in the Country Paradise Garden is doing well enough. Mm. All I would say is maybe the leaves are slightly smaller than the other ones. So it sometimes, for no apparent reason, might work. So it may be that your soil is slightly on the alkaline side, but it just seems to work. Mm. And if it does, I'd carry on. That's fine if they're doing well like that. Mm. But watering is not easy to get right, I have to say.
I know.
Yeah?
Thank you very
much. Okay.
Thank you.
Hi. During this heatwave, I've been trying to recycle my household water, i.e. filling basins with washing up water, filling the bath with soap or shampoo. Am I doing my plants a disfavour? Or should I be careful? Will the chemicals in any soapy water or shampoo ironically reduce their health?
I think with what you would use in a bath or a shower isn't going to do your plants any harm at all. You obviously wouldn't want to be pouring loads of products into the water and then watering your plants. I don't know at what level it would become harmful, but they call it grey water, you know, the water that comes from your bath or washing, and it's perfectly fine. I do that at home, actually. We pump the water out around the garden, and I've never had anything die.
And it's okay to do containers as well. Yeah. I mean, I've been filling up buckets from the bath and from the kitchen sink.
Yeah. I've literally, in the last couple of months, persuaded my younger brother, who, let's say, is a big novice in gardening.
A big novice.
In the, he's an ex-teacher, and he likes all the environmental side of things and mows the grass under duress. That's what sort of a gardener he is. All right, but he's very keen on recycling the water, so I've been setting him up with that, and he fills his water butts. He siphons his bath water out of the bath and into the water butts. So his water butts are full, whereas most people's have been empty for a long, long, long time, you know. But as John said, you know, even if you use general product, then the volume that it's diluted down to isn't really problematic for the garden. Obviously, stuff that maybe, you know, if you could divert it out of the dishwasher, which you don't think most people can, is not good, because that's quite powerful stuff. But, you know, at home I use environmentally friendly washing up liquid and soaps and things like that. And so everything that goes on the garden is natural anyway. So that's not a problem. What I would also say to you, which is worth bearing in mind, is that, you know, washing up water, because it's got washing up liquid in it, you could use that for watering on or spraying on to kill things like green fly and stuff like that, because that's what the washing up liquid does. We use that in the garden and in the nursery, actually, to kill those sort of things. So it breaks down their protective outer coating, and then we hope they die a long pain. No, we don't. They then succumb to the environment, basically, and die. So it's a double-edged thing, really. So you're absolutely doing the right thing. And recycling water is absolutely vital, bearing in mind how these weather patterns are changing now. We need to maximise everything, you know, and so looking at all of those things, and it's great that you're doing that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad. Thank you.
Anybody else with a question?
We've been admiring your grass and the fact that it's doing remarkably well, considering the heat and that. When we first moved into our house, we had a beautiful lawn, because the guy who owned the house before, his passion was lawns. Unfortunately, we seem to have killed it, mostly. It's just very baked, very dry. I'm sure lots of people have got the same problem. We did try reseeding some of it, and the seeds didn't seem to want to take. We went through the process of trying to scarify it and so on. We're not having a lot of luck with it, really. What would you recommend? If you've got an existing lawn and it really wants sorting out, what's the best way?
When you say it's baked, is that just this year or for two years?
Yeah.
Okay, two hot summers.
I've scarified it, I've seeded it, I've fed it.
Did it come back at all in the autumn last year?
It did come back. And, but it's just like, yeah. Now I'm starting to think...
The chap you bought it from wasn't a barber, was he, by any chance?
No.
Because every time I go to get my hair cut, you know, he insists, the chap I go and see in Oakham, he insists on showing me his pictures of his lawn. He's so proud of his lawn. I just wondered if it was the same chap. That was all. Yeah, so I'll pass this one on to John, I think, to start with.
Well, the lawn care here is very basic. Once upon a time, we did used to scarify every year. We used to try and aerate, but the ground is so hard here that it generally break the machines, and we would feed. But the only thing is when you feed, our grass just grows and grows, and then you have to cut it even more. Yeah. So it seemed a bit of an odd thing to do, because it's green most of the year. We do suffer in prolonged drought periods. It turns brown. Some areas are worse than others, but as soon as some moisture comes back, it will green up again.
It does green back up. It's just, you sort of think you've done all that effort to have another summer of it just sort of baked, I'm just going to have to scarify it again.
One of the problems I find is that where we have reseeded it and where little patches have took, you've got this wonderful green, fantastically fresh looking grass, and then loads of this sort of more rye grass and all different sized leaves, and it sort of looks awful. It's almost to the point where I want to just take the whole thing up and start again.
Well, what's your soil like?
We're Nottinghamshire, so
okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more work to begin with, but if you want to improve it, you could do really with, I don't know how big the area is, but you could ideally dig it all up and start afresh, but that would mean rotivating it all and then levelling it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to get a good lawn on ground that is a bit rough and you don't know quite what's underneath, it can be very patchy. So the only way, really, is to start again, get it all even, and get the air back into it.
So if we did that, and rotovated it, which would be great because I'd love to hire a rotovator and have a bit of fun with that. Would you then seed it or would you go down the turf route?
You have both options. Turf is obviously a faster result. You get it down and it gets rooted faster and you can therefore use it sooner. Seeding is much cheaper and also easy to do, but you might have to protect it a bit from birds.
Is the preparation with the soil being rubbish? Would you need to compost it or something after you'd rotated it?
Only if it's really, you know, awful, like grey clay or something.
Topsoil, possibly.
That would be better if you could, yeah.
Yeah.
So you want a good fine tilth. Once it's rotovated, then you'd rake it about and level it and firm it down somewhat. But, yeah, you need it to be very crumbly. You don't want great clods of clay in it.
I think this might be an option because we've been looking around all your wonderful gardens and going, why have we got the lawn in the middle? You know, the usual lawn in the middle, gardens around the outside. We'd love to have a little bit of lawn and a lot more interest, a lot less lawn and a lot more interest.
Yeah, so you could remove some of it and have some more planted areas.
Yeah.
To be fair, we do hear quite a lot about people saying, oh, you know, I'm fed up with plants and whatever, I'm just going to grass everything, without realising actually that grass takes a lot more maintenance than borders do. In order to keep them properly. I just wanted to pick up on one or two points that you mentioned. When you drive round or walk round your locality, is everybody else's grass in the same state?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you'd say that. And therefore, that's down to the climate, which you can do. I mean, I say you can do nothing about it. You actually can. You can do the right things in order to help. As long as everybody else follows suit, then we're quits in. But people aren't, so the climate is changing. And the problem is that when we get these long dry spells, as we had last year, the grass will go brown. Absolutely do not water it. It's a complete waste of water. The reason we use grass is because it is so resilient. It will bounce back. Now, you know, reseeding an established lawn is not necessarily great with this sort of weather because obviously young grass will suffer more because it's not so well established as the grass you've already got. When you say your soil is rubbish, what do you mean by that? You mean it's rubbish because it's clay or just because it doesn't grow stuff very well?
Well, I have tried to aerate it as well, the lawn, to try and improve aeration and keep the roots going. It's just a big clay pan. You've got solid clay. I've been doing it with a fork instead of a tine. You suddenly, within that, you're hitting the clay.
Yeah.
It's on an old floodplain.
The builders just put a layer of topsoil down.
Oh, they don't even do that. They scrape the topsoil away and then leave you with the rubbish and put turf on it. Yeah.
If you dig down, there's rocks and rubble.
You know, obviously, when you first started, you said you took over a lovely lawn from a chap who loved his lawn. So, I mean, it can be done, is the point, in the situation it's in.
Yeah.
So if you look at that, do you know where he's moved to?
He's gone upstairs.
So he's departed this mortal coil.
Yeah,
so
he's looking down on me, frowning, and saying, what have you done
well,
to
if
my
you,
lawn?
If you want to grease my palms, I've got a direct line. No, I haven't. Okay, so my point being that it can be achieved is the point. And, you know, what we need to look at is how things are going. I work very much on the principle in the garden is that, you know, if it doesn't look good, then don't look at it. All right. So my point being that I did a guided walk last year for a group, and a lady asked me, we got to the two cottage gardens, the artisans and the gentleman's cottage garden, and directly opposite those is the wildlife border. And this was early September. And we were almost at the point where we were going to strim it down and then mow it again, waiting for everything to seed down. And so it looked really tatty. But in order to get the beauty that we get from it, we have to go through that. And a lady asked me a question about it, and I started talking to her, and she was looking at me in an odd way. I said, I can't turn around and look at it. I said, because it looks tatty, and I don't want to depress myself by the fact that it looks tatty. So I'm going to stand here and look at the Arsans Cottage Garden, which looks a lot more beautiful. And that's the point. So what I mean is that don't work yourself up about it. Understand that it will bounce back. Yeah. You know, because absolutely, the thing is, you painted a picture of it being in a terrible state. So, you know, part of the advice of that is start again. Yeah. But what I'm saying to you is that when you took it over, it wasn't. Mm. And my general feeling from listening to what you said is that it is just the climate that's doing it. So even if you've started for it again, if the climate stays like this, you will end up going down the same route. Now, what we hope is that next year, we end up with a summer like we were used to when we were kids, which is a mishmash of everything.
Yeah.
not snow, obviously, in the summer, but rain and sun and rain and sun, a bit of wind and whatever. And if we get that, then your grass will be lovely and green all the way through. God forbid that we get to the situation that they got to some years ago in California, where it was so dry all of the time that most people took up their lawn and put green tarmac down instead, because the grass just was continually brown because it was so dry and hot, you know. But I do think, you know, you look at ours and you say yours is compacted. Can you imagine how many feet go over ours?
Yeah.
And we are literally, you know, if you go up to the Country Paradise Garden end there, what have we got, about 6 inches of topsoil there, if that?
Yeah.
4 to 6 inches of topsoil.
Shallow.
Before you hit solid limestone. Yeah. And the grass is quite happy up there.
So the final, you know, question then might be, if we decided to try and repair it or start again, is there a particular season that's best to do it in?
Autumn.
Obviously not now.
Autumn.
Yeah. Autumn's a good time, although saying that, you know, I once spoke to a dairy farmer about grass. And obviously important for him because his cows were eating it. And he always said to me, oh, well, whenever I re-sow, I always re-sow in July because it's really quite a wet month. July, people don't realise how wet it is. And I'm sat here looking at very brown grass, middle of July. So autumn generally tends to be the time to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say that your father was a great influence to me.
So oh, good.
It's lovely. I've got his ornamental kitchen garden book. For
yeah.
years I've had that. So my sister's a gardener, but he really got me into loving my garden and following him. So
yeah,
a
well,
lot of his little tips that I
yeah,
still
well,
follow.
I mean, dig up your lawn and grow veg. It tastes an awful lot better.
We're seriously thinking about doing that.
Because that was going to be... I've always followed an ornamental kitchen garden.
Yeah.
So I just thought, do you know what? I'm going to make those beds bigger.
Yeah, good.
But
yeah.
I hate to undo the previous person's...
Yeah, you know, I spoke to an elderly lady a few years ago now, and she said to me, she was quite sad about the fact that her husband had died. She'd had to downsize because the house and the garden were too big. And I said to her, you know, the garden should always be a pleasure, never a chore. You know, if you wake up in the morning thinking, oh, 'cause I've got to do something today in the garden because otherwise it's going to get away from me, then the garden's too big for you. And so you either need to change the way that the garden is or change the garden. And then she went on to say that she then was lumbered with grandparent duty, something that we never signed up to when we have children. Our generation never signed up to that, and suddenly that appeared. And so she would go 3 times a week to her daughter's house. And in doing so, passed her old house that she'd moved from, and she said, oh, it's so depressing, she said, because they've had the big JCBs in there, they've ripped out everything that we did over 30 years in that garden, and she said, it's so sad. And I said to her, what was the garden like when you moved in? She said, oh, it was terrible. I mean, they didn't know what they were doing. They had this, that. And so we took most of it out and redid it. And I said to her, you know, at the end of the day, a garden is your own place, your own space. You do what you want with it. You should never worry about what other people think about it. It's your space. If they think your plants clash but you love it, then who cares, really, in that respect? And I said to her, you know, at the end of the day, the garden has to suit their needs. It's their house now. I said to her, is there a different way you can go to your daughter? She said, oh, you know, it adds about 5 minutes to my journey. I said, well, go that way. Yeah. And that's the thing. The point is, it is now yours. The person who was there is no longer there. You know, I mean, I've been the owner of this garden since the 5th of August, 1996. So my dad died the day before in a charity cycle ride, and the garden then passed to me. Now, I do without... You know, obviously I've been brought up, you know, indoctrinated in the Jeff Hamilton style of gardening without a question. But the point is, every time that, you know, I talk to John about what we're going to do or we decide what we're going to do and things, I don't think, oh, I wonder what my dad would think first. The reason that we still have gardens here from his time is because what we're all about are the ideas. You know, we're about giving people an enjoyable visit, but also giving them ideas to take home with them. And the point is, when a garden doesn't do that anymore, then we redevelop it.
Yeah.
There's no historical nature to anything. A garden is a work in progress at the end of the day, and everybody stamps their own mark on it. You know, now if you like what the person had done before you, then by all means keep bits that you like without any thought of that. And yes, you remember the person that was there before when you look at them. But you should never be guided by what you think they want, because they're not living there anymore. You know, so you do your own thing. Any other questions?
Other than geraniums, what flowers would you plant that don't mind a drought?
Well, obviously, plants come in all shapes and sizes. Are you talking more perennial, herbaceous?
Yeah, maybe my age, quite a few raised beds now and tubs.
Okay. Well, plants that have silver leaves, grey leaf, silver leaves, tend to be more drought tolerant. So things like lavenders, santalina, cotton lavender, rosemary, and things like catmint, nepeta are very good. When you say geraniums, do you mean the hardy geraniums or like pelargoniums?
Not pelargoniums, no.
Hardy geraniums. Mm. Yeah, they're very good.
They're lovely, yeah.
And Alcamilla mollis, lady's mantle, that's very good in drought.
Now, I'm having trouble with that as well, me and my watering probably, but I've put it with roses under a rose tree because I looked it up and said, you know, where could I put it? And it recommended that, and I lost it, so it's probably me again.
Alcamilla's a very easy plant, so yeah, it doesn't require much attention once it's established.
Was I right? Was it okay to put it with the roses?
Yeah.
It's a really good plant for that. Mm. I mean, I don't want to worry you, but I'd class that as bomb proof.
Is it time to give up gardening?
No, when you say it went, I mean,
we're a south-facing garden.
Yeah.
It's bungalow, so we've nothing really overpowering the garden, so it's getting a lot of sun. And it came sort of to start with, but it didn't make anything.
Did you water it?
Yes, of course, because, well, once again, it was in a huge tub.
Oh, it's in a tub.
I tend to do a lot of tub gardening that I can cope with.
So in... Oh, right, OK. So are your roses in containers as well?
They're fabulous. I've grown them right.
But they're in containers?
Over a big arch, yes.
Yeah, OK. Yeah. The difficulty, I think, sometimes is the fact that, you know, Alcamilla mollis has quite a soft leaf, a very hairy leaf. So as John was saying, you know, lots of the silver leaf plants. So if you add to his list something like lamb's ears, what's now called Stachys byzantina, it's a very tactile plant, very soft and very hairy. Mm. But what those hairs do is that they trap the little water droplets and keep them on the leaf there so that the leaf doesn't dry. That's how they're drought tolerant in that respect. Mm. Obviously, silvery grey leaves also reflect the sun, which helps with that. The problem with growing roses in containers is that they like moisture retention roses. Now, our roses here root into our clay lower down where there's a moisture reservoir, but obviously the soil at the top dries quite well, but the roots are down in the moist bit.
Mm.
So we could grow things like lavender, rosemary, nepeta and all that in it, Alcamilla mollis, but of course all of those drought tolerant plants are surface rooting. And like it, and therefore are used to it being quite dry. Well, if your roses want it wet in a container, you're watering. Do you see what I mean about the difference between a container and the soil? So realistically, what you need to do is to look at plants that can cope with a little bit more moisture and a container. So that would limit really a lot of what you can do. So things like geraniums are great. You know, they do well in something like that because they're tough as old boots. But obviously south facing is going to make it difficult as well in that respect because a lot of the plants that like it really sunny and hot also like it dry. So in other containers, it's a funny thing because, you know, lots of people recommend things like lavender to go with roses and stuff like that. But of course, the situations that they both like are totally different. But as I say, the roses will root a lot deeper, whereas the lavender stays quite hard, like your Alcamilla. So I think that, again, they've probably got too wet to do that. So it's a little bit more complicated, I think, if you're going to do that in containers.
As I say, most things I grow come beautifully. You know, I buy plants that they're selling off that they think are dead. I can bring them home, get them back to life, you know, and get them planted. I don't lose many things.
No. That's all right, because that wasn't, I have to say, it wasn't the impression you were given at the beginning.
I know. It really isn't, is it? I've got, you know, these roses I'm growing in containers have been there 3 years. We've got them right over the arch, you know. They started about here. So whatever they're in, they're loving, but there is a lot of manuring with them.
Yeah, that's fine. The other thing that I think that might be worthwhile looking at is getting a means of watering your containers with your roses in them so that you're getting the water actually into the pot and not watering on the top. Because if you can keep that sort of top 3 or 4 inches a little bit drier, then you could grow things like nepeta and lavender and your Alcamilla and stuff in there. So the classic way to do that is to look at something like an old sort of water bottle or something, cut the bottom off, take the top off the other end and put it down in, so that's just sitting on the surface. So when you water into that, And then that's going right down to halfway down the pot, which means your top half is staying a little bit drier.
Yeah.
And then things won't be rotting. So try that. If it works, then I'm on commission, I'm saying.
We've mounted up a few wine bottles and push them in.
Oh, wine bottles. There we are. Yeah, you have to grind the bottom off.
Well, just because the plastic tends to sink, close in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Pop the plastic ones in.
Yeah.
Tried a few things.
Yeah.
But what were they all are at the
You're just finding a reason, aren't you, to get down the wine aisle?
I've got about 30 washing up bowls that my tubs all stand in while we're away. And the same with tomatoes in the greenhouse. They're all in washing up tubs, but I'm only growing cherry ones.
Right, okay.
So I live by the...
No, it's a great thing to do. But like I say, if you try and get that water a little bit lower in, and so you're not actually watering on the top, then it'll open up what you're able to do.
Like different water.
Yeah.
I won't grow them in there.
And then you can look at the recommendations that John gave with the silvery leaf, the hairy leaf, you know, things. And of course, Alchemilla is hairy leaf, so all of those sort of things that do really well.
Lovely, thank you.
Oh, question there.
It's sort of along the same theme, really. Thinking sort of pragmatically into the future with predictions of climate getting much hotter and drier, what do you think the practical solution is as far as watering is concerned? Should we be digging things out and thinking, actually, let's get more tolerant varieties in? Or do you think it's worth looking after what we've got despite hosepipe bans and so on and so forth?
Well, I'd say it depends how much time you've got to give the extra care and do you really love that plant that much. But there are certain plants here that really aren't enjoying this weather, like rudbeckias and astrantias. They're flopping most of the time and we do go around and water them. But with hosepipe bans and things, it's going to become more of a problem. So unless you can collect your own water or recycle what you're using from the house. But yes, I certainly think there's option for replacing some of the more problematic plants with things that will tolerate the drier, hotter weather. But you've also then got to take into consideration a lot of those plants don't like the wet winters.
Yeah.
So somewhere in between. I know we are having hotter, longer, drier summers. There's no guarantee it will continue year after year. It might, but it might not. So, how much time do you want to spend watering your plants?
I think that John's right. There's no guarantee as to what's going to happen next year. We've had two very wet winters, two very wet summers consecutively, but that doesn't mean that that's going to carry on. And the Met Office report that they issued spoke about, as other organisations are speaking about, just focusing on the long, hot, dry summers. But what they're not really talking about, which John mentioned, was the wet winters that we're getting. Now, if you go out and go home now and dig up all of your plants that don't like the hot and dry and plant, replace all with Mediterranean plants, what if we do then carry on getting very wet winters? The thing is that they don't like that. That's not a situation they like. Now, I was also reading a report, and I can't remember the acronym that they use for it now, but it was all about the currents of the sea, which go right down the south of the world and up to the Arctic Circle and back round, and they influence the weather. And what they were talking about is because the sea is warming, because the salt water is being diluted by melting glaciers and melting Arctic Circle and things, that we're likely to get more... sort of both ends of the scale, much more extreme weather. So they're talking about potentially it becoming really quite cold as well through the winter. Now, if we get wet and cold, your Mediterranean plants stand no chance at all. So when you look at the moment, we take it as what's happening at the moment, because some scientists agree, some scientists disagree with that theory about the sea and whatever. But the thing is, it's out there. But if we take what we're doing at the moment, which is long, hot, dry summers, very, very, very wet winters. Now, bear in mind that for 6 weeks this last winter, there were quite a few areas in the garden that were underwater for 6 weeks. Now, the thing is, the way I look at it is the fact that there are things we can do to conserve water. in the garden. There are also things, as we were talking about earlier on, about bath water and sink water and all of this, and reusing the grey water, which is vitally important. We do that as well. And so we can mulch, we can add organic matter to the soil, which all help to retain the moisture, help to stop the evaporation, all that sort of stuff. So in actual fact, there are things that we can do in the summer. Although there are hose pipe bans, there is no ban on using a watering can where things are desperate. And only where things are desperate. What we can't do in the winter is to suck the excess water out of the ground. So in actual fact, the wet winters are more problematic in a way than the dry summers in that respect. You know, and we've found here, although, you know, things like the Rudbeckias are suffering and other things, they will bounce back. We're forecast, I'm touching as much wood as I can, we're forecast some rain within just over a week's time or in about a week's time. And if we get two or three days of rain, light rain to start with and maybe a little bit heavier to go on, things will suddenly start to reshoot and look really fresh again. So they're really quite resilient, and it's about getting your head in the right place and understanding that whatever you do, the weather will dictate what happens. But like I say, the problem is that in this country we're now getting the two extremes. If it was one or the other, we could shift one way or the other. Sorry, I'm just sat here and I can see a big clump of elephant's ears, the begonia, on the corner of the herb garden there, and that plant is bomb-proof, like the alchemilla, but that will grow anywhere.
They're very drought-tolerant.
Hi, I have a limited budget, and when I buy plants, the first thing I say is it perennial? Can it keep going? So if I buy an Agapanthus navy blue, £19 in a supermarket. So how can I be sure? What should I do with my Agapanthus roots or bulbs? I have them in two pots and they're thriving, and the same with the dahlias. What should I do once they stop flowering with the tubers or the bulbs to give them long life?
So you've got them in pots. Are they large pots? Is this a recent thing?
Yeah, the Agapanthus are in large pots and they're doing fantastic. I'm going out with the bathwater. And so are the dahlias. And I was really reassured that you've this amazing display of dahlias here in pots. They seem to love being clustered together.
Yeah, well, the dahlias in the pots, of course, the dahlias are tender. So they do have to come in for the winter into a frost-free place. And we just leave them completely dry in those pots. But we do have to water them almost daily at this time of the year. But, yeah, we take those away. We do grow dahlias in the ground as well and leave them in through the winter. And they survived really well, actually, this last winter. But they need to be able to shed the water through the winter. And even though it was a wet winter, they did really well. But they're in slightly raised beds, the ones that we have outside. And we mulched them over with some leaf mould. And they came back really well. Agapanthuses, so you're just growing them in pots, not in the ground.
Yes.
Yeah. They actually like to have a really tight root system, Agapanthus do. So if they're in a pot and they look a bit cramped, don't worry about that because they seem to flower better in a restricted pot. They still need good drainage. They make sure you've got good drainage holes in the bottom and maybe put some crock in there or gravel to let them drain freely because they really don't like being sat in the wet, especially in the winter time. They can rot off. And there are different types of Agapanthus. Some are more hardy than others. They're all perennial, but in a pot, those roots are more exposed to the cold temperatures. If we have a really cold winter, you'd be safe to bring it in somewhere frost-free, ideally, for the winter. Maybe not even frost-free, but somewhere dry for the winter and then pull it back out again in the spring.
So would it be best to bring the pot with the bulb in and the soil in somewhere and just keep it warm? And the same with the dahlias, just bring, don't take them out of the pots.
You can grow both of them well in pots or in the ground, but the dahlias are more likely to suffer in the winters if you have a wet winter and you've got a heavy ground. The Agapanthuses here that we've got planted out, they seem to be tough as old boots as well. They come back year after year. So once they've finished flowering, the seed pods can still look quite attractive, even when the flowers have gone. But when they're past their best, we'll cut the flower spikes back and then just let the leaves yellow off and clear that away later in the year.
Thank you. I think the important with your agapanthus, are they evergreen or deciduous varieties?
They're just incredibly dramatic. It's a navy, it's almost black.
Yeah.
I got each of them in the range in a pot, and I put them in two separate pots, and they just love the sun.
Have you done that this year?
Yes.
And what size pot did you buy them in?
I bought them in a sort of medium-sized pot, which was too small, so I transferred them into pots about the size of those speakers.
Yeah. So they've gone into comparatively quite a large pot from a small pot.
So I have each of them in a very large pot.
So what you need to bear in mind is what John said to you, which is the fact that they flower much better when they have a congested root. And the reason for that is because it's stressful. And if you think about it, it's only humans that the only thing really put on this planet that their main objective isn't to reproduce. You know, a human's main objective, other objectives they have, we do tend to predominantly reproduce, but plants and animals, they just want to produce their next generation. So you can understand that if something is under stress, then it's more likely to want to produce seed because it thinks it's going to die. It's not necessarily. So, for example, if you've got a lovely row of lettuce and you don't water it in weather like this for a couple of days, it runs straight to seed because it thinks it's going to die. So therefore, that's what you're trying to create with your agapanthus. They come from an environment that is very sparse in its soil type, and we pot them up generally into fairly good compost. So the worry is that next year what you'll get is lots of leaf and not so much flower because they're too comfortable, they're too well fed. And so I would just be a little bit thoughtful of that. And if that happens, then it may be an idea the following spring to take them out and put them in a smaller pot. But deciduous agapanthus are far hardier than evergreen agapanthus. You know, the way the winters are going now, most agapanthus are quite hardy through the winter. It's not so problematic. But, you know, John's right about keeping them dry. The problem with agapanthus and with dahlias is when they shoot in the spring, you can stick your dahlias in a garage, it's fine. But the point is, it's too dark when it's starting to try and grow. So it's almost a case of, oh, you know, on most days I can take them out, but then I've got to bring them back in because it's going to get too cold, and there are lots of backwards and forwards. So a cold greenhouse or a conservatory would do a job with that. And certainly your agapanthus, you could move against a south facing house wall, west facing house wall, and no matter how insulated they are, there is a certain amount of radiant heat that comes out, and that tends to keep them going fairly well. But of course, being under the eaves, it stops a lot of the rain coming into the pot, and so you can do that. But your dahlias, the reason that John, you know, keeps our dahlias just bone, doesn't water them, is because if you lift them out of the ground, you dry them out before you store them. So the tubers don't mind being dry. Whereas if you brought your agapanthus in, you would just have to keep the compost barely moist. You don't want to dry those out too much, because otherwise you'll desiccate the root. It's a different beast, as it were, in that respect. So keeping them outside sort of helps a little bit with that if you can. Have we got another question, or are we all questioned out? Well, I think we're about done now. So thank you very much for that. Some really good questions.
Thank you.
Really good question. We learnt a lot about some people.
When I lived in the north, a friend gave me a cutting of the mullet, and I planted it in my front garden facing north in soil. I'm planting all these in tubs, and that's where I think I'm going wrong. I'm not getting the watering right.
Yeah.
It grew perfectly in
soil. Yeah, I think that's the case. The whole point is that, and this is the great thing, and I keep saying to people, you know, that no matter how long you live, right, and no matter how many people you know, there will never be anybody who knows everything there is to know about gardening or horticulture generally. It's too vast a subject to do that. I've been doing this professionally for, 46 years I've been doing this professionally for now, and I'm still learning. Every day, you know, and so it's nothing to be worried about or depressed about. The point is that, you know, unless somebody tells you, how do you know? You know, do you remember when Delia Smith was berated terribly all over the newspapers and whatever, when she did that series about, and one of the things was showing people how to boil an egg. But of course, lots of parents weren't showing their children, as we got, how to cook. So if they're not shown how to do it, how do they know how to do it unless somebody shows them? You know, you look at, go to any university now, I bet your life that more than 75% of the students there live off on takeaways because they do not know how to cook, you know, and stuff. So the point is that unless you're told, how do you know? So now you've been told, You've been given free rein to go down the wine aisle as well. All right. You know, and so we look forward to hearing about successes next time.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you.